Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's day three of the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden is the party's official presidential nominee. Yesterday, we talked about the policies the Democrats are pushing forward in their platform. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Joe Biden himself. So today, let's look at the important piece of the puzzle between the two, the team that would put those ideas into place if Biden wins in November. Who's in his inner circle? The DNC is giving a lot of screen time to the party's rising stars, but the people closest to Biden include a coterie of longtime Washington insiders and lobbyists. So this hour on Point, if personnel is policy, as the saying goes, who are the people who got Joe Biden's ear? Well, we will begin today with Ayesha Mills. She's a Democratic political strategist and commentator. She's also a fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, former president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund, and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Ayesha, welcome back to On Point.
Hi. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let's get straight to the name that's most prominent and right next to Joe Biden's. It's Senator Kamala Harris, of course, who's going to be speaking tonight at the Democratic National Convention. But what are the important signals that you think Biden himself is sending regarding sort of what kind of team of advisors and close people he would surround himself with if he wins the presidency?
Yeah, so, you know, with the selection of Senator Harris as his running mate, the first signal before we even get to the governing was really around letting Black women, who are the foundation of the Democratic Party, who ultimately our votes continually matter in elections in a way that shifts them. What he did was he signaled that the party really deeply cares about the core constituency. That matters because in order to even get into a position where he's going to govern, he has to really unite the community and the base. And so I think he did that with the selection of Senator Harris. The other thing to note around personnel is that Corinne Jean-Pierre, who was a senior advisor on the campaign, has also now been named chief of staff to Senator Harris. Now, this is meaningful because Corinne comes from the progressive wing of the party. She was the chief spokesperson for MoveOn.org and also worked in the Obama administration. And so to have now the vice presidential candidate be a Black woman, a constituency that's so critical to the base of the party, and then to pair her with Corinne, who is someone who is respected as driving progressive policy, I think that that's a really good signaling to start in the VP office. Now, where we go from there in terms of how that looks with the people who are closest to him and his staff, I know gets a little bit more curious in terms of who to surround himself with.
Indeed. And we're actually going to spend the rest of the hour talking about exactly that, because it's a motley crew, to say the least, of old and new. But let me just ask you this quickly. You know, in a sense, the old saying goes that people don't necessarily vote for the second name on the ticket. But I would say that it's quite different this time around by virtue of the reasons that you talked about regarding who Senator Harris is and also who Joe Biden is. Just let's be blunt about it. Given his age, I mean, he's actually talked. The campaign has talked about his potential presidency in somewhat in transitional terms as well, and you can see that in sort of how the DNC is trying to present who the party is today. So do you think that that really this time around that people are going to be looking at both names on the ticket as influence on how they might cast their vote?
Yeah, what the party needed, and as a longtime, you know, lifetime Democrat, I felt the same way, is we needed a jolt of energy, a sense of hope we needed to have some vision of who we can be, something aspirational. That's what Barack Obama did with his campaign of hope and change back in 2008. It was surely about how we're going to govern in the short term because we're coming off of the heels of a war and economic calamity. And we could see the better angels in ourselves as a nation and the evolution of our democracy through him. I believe that that's what this ticket is attempting to do. Certainly, Joe Biden is someone who isn't going to be around forever, just given his age. He is at the end of his career. And what this choice of Kamala Harris has done is it said, we know that, you know, the next president is at the end of his career, but we are also building a bench and teeing up the next generation of the Democratic Party. That's what Kamala Harris symbolizes. And so I do think that there's, I have seen all of the enthusiasm over the last just week and a half of people super excited and engaged and feeling hope and feeling possibility again, which is what animates people and brings them out and turns them out to vote. Surely, you know, we resisted and resisted and resisted in 2018 and we were against something. But in order to really win back the White House, we have to be for something too. And Kamala Harris is an aspirational sense of the party and us as people, as Americans, and where we're going. And so I have looked, I've done the analysis too, like you did. And, you know, the data points show that the vice president has normally, you know, marginally mattered in any of this, right? They're just kind of the mm-hmm. running mate. But this is different. This is different.
Well, Aisha, if you could just hang on with me for a second. I want to spend a couple of minutes now with Representative James Clyburn. He serves as the House Majority Whip and is also, of course, Democratic representative for South Carolina's 6th Congressional District. Congressman Clyburn, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Congressman, in a second, I'm going to ask you about Senator Harris, now the official vice presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. But first, I got to ask you, what was it like giving your speech in this sort of unusual convention? You talked on Monday night. What was that like?
Well, it was a bit strange, but I really enjoyed doing it in the manner I did, because, as you know, I did it from Charleston. Mm-hmm. The whole theme for the first night was unity. And I thought that it would be good to do it from Charleston, across the street from Emmanuel Church, five blocks from Gaston Wharf, and across the street to my right was the spot that the John C. Calhoun statue that the city of Charleston had just brought down. And so I thought that it was fitting for me to talk about our roots and how far we've come and the fact that we did it all together and to talk about the future and what we needed to do in order to take from that soil of Charleston, where about 80% of African Americans in this country can trace at least one of their roots back to Gaston Wharf. And so my theme was just about how far we've come and what we can do going together. You know, Emmanuel right. Church, I think, taught us a whole lot. The reaction to a white supremacist going into a Bible study, murdering 9 people and proclaiming that he wanted to start a race war. But that's not what he got. He unified that community. He unified this state. And he set a course that led to, I would say, the Black Lives Matter movement. People saw something in the mm-hmm. Emmanuel AME Church incident that started us on the course that we're on today. And I yeah. think that the Black Lives Matter movement is a foundation that we can all build upon. And I'm glad to see you getting so much acceptance.
Well, Congressman Clyburn, I've only got you for a couple of more minutes here, so let me just get then straight to this question of the leadership team that is surrounding or might surround Joe Biden here. What would you like to hear Senator Sarah Harris say tonight in her speech to the nation as she speaks now as the official vice presidential nominee?
Well, I've always said to Kamala what I've said to everybody in this business, be yourself. I think that Kamala has a tremendous amount of support all across the board. When I was campaigning here in South Carolina, we had over 20 presidential candidates here. And people in South Carolina fell in love with her. They were also in love with Joe Biden. And so many people said to me, I would just love to see a Biden-Harris ticket. And this was way back in January and February when people were saying that to me. And that's what we've got. And I really believe this is, I won't call it a dream ticket, but I think it's a ticket that a lot of us have dreamed about for a long time. I happen to be the father of three African-American women, and this is the ticket they wanted to see.
Hmm. Well, who else then, if Joe Biden wins in November, who else would you like to see sort of in some key cabinet positions?
Well, I don't know if I'll get into names, but I want to see African-Americans in non-traditional roles. You know, I think the Department of Housing and Urban Development is a very important department. So is the Department of Commerce, etc. I'd love to see African Americans in places like the Treasurer. I want to see some non-traditional stuff. I want to see an African American woman on the Supreme Court. I think it's a shame we've had four women on the Supreme Court here in this country, and no one's ever given serious thought to an African American woman. That's one of the things I said to Joe Biden before I ever endorsed him. As I'm got to tell you, I want to see an African-American woman on the Supreme Court. Make that your first appointment. I don't know if he'll make it his first or not, but he is committed publicly more than once to put an African-American woman on the Supreme Court. So I want to see some non-traditional stuff. That's the kind of stuff I think will demonstrate that he is serious about uniting this country.
Well, Congressman James Clyburn, House Majority Whip and Representative for South Carolina's 6th Congressional District. Congressman Clyburn, thank you, as always, for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Aisha, we got to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how even though Congressman Clyburn may want to see some non-traditional appointments in a putative Biden administration, he's surrounded right now by some pretty traditional people as well. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Joe Biden's inner circle and the people that he might appoint to, say, cabinet positions if he wins in November. And the reason why we're talking about that is because, as the old saying goes, personnel is policy in Washington. So what might that personnel be, and what influence might they have in a putative Biden administration? We're joined by Aisha Mills today. She's a Democratic political strategist and commentator, a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics, and former president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund. And I want to bring into the conversation now Robert Kuttner. He's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School for Policy and Management, also author of The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. Bob Kuttner, great to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I was really interested to hear Congressman Clyburn say that he wants some non-traditional figures at the top levels of what could be a Biden administration. But he's also talking about a person in Joe Biden that's been a creature of Washington for several decades now and is surrounding himself by some very traditional names. So what do you think about that?
So for starters, you have a kind of a disjuncture between Biden's policy papers, which are terrific, which reflect the fact that the party base has been moving in a more progressive direction, and the people who he is most comfortable with, who are pretty much the old Clinton-Obama team, who were liberal-ish on social issues, but very traditional on economic issues. And the fact that Wall Street got a hammerlock on the economy and that corporate concentration increased, both of which factors added up to the widening income inequality and insecurity of ordinary people. That happened under Democrats as well as Republicans. And unfortunately, and I'm happy to name names, many of the people who were part of Biden's inner circle are part of that crowd. So since personnel is policy, and after the campaign's over, you might as well have a bonfire and burn all the policy papers. The real question is, who is he going to appoint to the power positions, not just a Secretary of Labor, which ordinarily goes to a liberal, or even HUD and HHS, but to Treasury and National Economic Council and OMB and U.S. Trade Rep. Those are the positions, and the Fed, of course, the Federal Reserve, those are the positions that really dictate the economic direction of the country, which in turn limit the kind of structural changes that can be made if the wrong people get those jobs.
Mm. Well, so I'll have you name names here in a second, but Aisha, I just wanted to get your response to what Bob said first.
Yeah, no, Bob is absolutely right. And I just want to illuminate for people what we mean when we say that personnel is policy. When I ran the LGBTQ Victory Institute, one of our signature projects was what we called a presidential appointment project, where we put together a binder full of LGBTQ qualified people who could serve in some of these appointed positions in the administration. It mattered because at the time that Obama came into office, we did not have full equality around America for LGBTQ people. Frankly, we still don't. And so the idea that who gets those jobs in the cabinet, surely that's the high level, but the day-to-day operating of the government. So be it at the Department of Justice and the Office of Civil Rights, who is doing the lawsuits there, at HHS, who is expanding, you know, healthcare under ACA, those jobs really matter and are our opportunity to create some equity in the way the public policy is implemented in America. And so the people who hold those jobs should come from more diverse lenses and frankly be reflective of and connected to the people who actually are affected by policy, which is all of us Americans, right? And that hadn't always been the case. So I'm proud that Obama Biden ended up appointing more LGBTQ people to the administration than ever before in history. And to Mr. Clyburn's point, those were in significantly non-quote-unquote expected roles. So, for example, one of our most senior officials was Eric Fanning, who was the Secretary of the Army, who happened to be a gay man. We also happened to have a transgender woman who was serving in the Pentagon. That mattered because we also were able to dismantle the don't ask, don't tell policy and all of the challenges that had happened because of that to queer people, trans people within the DOJ, for example. So when we talk about what personnel is policy, the people absolutely matter. And I am too looking forward to having someone, especially when we think about economic policy. We are facing a very deep and widening wealth gap in America. It is clearly along racial lines, but women still, you know, are underpaid relative to men. And that is just continuing to be exacerbated because corporations, you know, the 1% are making a ton of money and leaving average workers behind. And so to have someone at who is setting economic policy, be it at Commerce, be it at Treasury, that really has an understanding of structural inequality matters. And so, you know, that's why we're talking about all of this. And it is important because, you know, Joe Biden's been a statesman, been around a really long time, and, you know, has done the business as usual in Washington. And some would argue that Obama tried to do business differently. But aside from him being historic, a lot of the way that the administration operated was pretty, you know, pretty much the way that government operates. And so can we shake it up? Will Kamala Harris be able to shake it up? Will Joe Biden appoint people who are going to shake it up? Certainly, you know, thinking about the Department of Justice as well. Donald Trump is going to be on the outside and be back to being an average citizen. Are we going to have someone at the Department of Justice who then, you know, goes after some of his improprieties? All of those things matter and who he puts in place. And that person's got to be comfortable being a disruptor, being responsive to and reflective of average Americans.
Well, you know, Bob, hearing Aisha talk about how in many ways the Obama administration was sort of business as usual in government, of course, Joe Biden was the vice president in that administration. So let's pick up this thought about the sort of power positions, as you were saying, Treasury, Commerce, OMB, Trade. It is interesting that right now, in terms of some of the people who've been pulled into the campaign as advisors, they're not exactly the, you know, the progressive voices that the progressive left would hope for. I mean, I know that lots of people went apoplectic in finding out that Larry Summers was sort of back in the fray as an advisor.
Well, happily, Larry Summers is now out of the fray. But here's the problem. Barack Obama did rather well at appointing high officials, in his phrase, who look like America. The problem is you can look like America in the sense of being diverse, racially diverse in terms of gender, and also look like Wall Street. So you've got a number of axes here where Biden has to break with the past. And some of his top people, his former chiefs of staff, Steve Ricchetti and Bruce Reed, in particular, are from the center-right wing of the party on the economic issues. That's really my beat. The only one who's a progressive who worked closely in the Senate with Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and progressives who really wanted to shake up Wall Street was Ted Kaufman, Biden's longtime chief of staff, who then served out the last 2 years of Biden's Senate term, turned out to be a terrific senator. Kaufman is the head of transition. But he's won against about six or seven who are much more traditionalist. So I think the progressive community is in a real bind right now. On the one hand, everybody feels we got to get rid of Donald Trump. We've got to be unified in electing Joe Biden. And at the same time, if you can walk and chew gum at the same time, fight like the devil to make sure that the power positions, at least some of them, don't go to the usual Wall Street club.
Right. Well, you know, so let's sort of dig into this even in a more pointed way. And my major tip of the hat to the reporting that's come from The Prospect, Bob, because there's, you know, there's the question of lobbyists at one time that like former or even very recently former lobbyists that Biden might be listening to right now. And in addition, The Prospect's done this really great reporting about the murky world of strategists, right, in Washington. So these strategic groups that former high-ranking members of administrations, when they're done with their public work, they go and basically become strategists for defense contractors, major corporations, et cetera. And The Prospect has reported it quite deeply about how many of those people are back in the Biden campaign. I'm just going to read some names here. We've got Nick Burns, who's with the Cohen Group, Kurt Campbell, the Asia Group, Tom Donilon, BlackRock, Wendy Sherman, Albright Stonebridge, Julian Smith, West Exec Advisors. Also, Anita Dunn, who's the chief campaign strategist, was still doing work for AT&T up until last month.
Yeah, and Steve Ricchetti, much of his career was sort of the epitome of the revolving door. You go from government, excuse me, and then you become a lobbyist for major corporations, then you go back to government, then you become a lobbyist again. So Biden, this is Biden's crowd, and he's comfortable with them. And the question is whether the influence of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, the progressive wing of the party, which is really behaving itself, really being very loyal to Biden Harris, will serve as a counterweight. And so you might get someone like Elizabeth Warren to be Treasury Secretary or to be Attorney General. And you might get someone who's not a traditional hyper-globalist to be in charge of trade policy. It's really important to get someone at OMB who, as soon as this immediate crisis is over, doesn't go back into we have to balance the budget mode. And that would be the kind of break that we really need with the past. But if he is listening to the same old advisors, we're going to have pretty much the same trajectory on these key pocketbook issues that we had with Clinton and Obama, even recognizing that Clinton and Obama did some great things in other aspects of public policy.
Aisha, do you want to comment on that?
No, I think that all of that is absolutely right. And here's the thing. We are in this 2020, well, frankly, since 2016, but surely 2020 has shown us that anything is possible, right? All things can be true at one time. And it feels like we are in this incredible moment of disruption where it's our opportunity to innovate. And innovation is not a word that people who are in government have ever really been comfortable with. Now is our time to do something dramatically different. Donald Trump got into office, frankly, because people wanted something that was different. Now, something that was, you know, we can argue the ideological merits of that. But again, people were thirsty for us to do something different. And I think that what Joe Biden can do right now is to take this moment in time and say, look, I've presided in government for, you know, my entire adult life, 40 something years. And not a lot has changed in terms of the disparities that we see across communities. Education is still horrible for most people in America. The racial lines around health and wealth are just exacerbating. What are we going to do about that? We've clearly got to change it up and do something different. I think now is the moment and the appetite for that. That is what the progressive wing is saying. They're like, yo, we've tried it this way forever. It's like, you know, the definition of insanity is kind of like banging your head against the wall over and over and over again, doing something the same way over and over and over, expecting different results. Well, we can't keep doing that. And so now we've got this opportunity to try something new. Will we have the courage to? That's the question.
Right. And, so let me just ask you then. Oh, go ahead, Bob. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, not just the courage, but the leverage. You know, Biden depended on the unity and the support of progressives. And the question is, given that everybody recognizes in the progressive community that we have to elect this guy, we have to maximize turnout, we have to muster some enthusiasm. And then with the other hand, we have to make sure that the appointments go to some good people. One other troubling detail, you know, Kamala Harris's brother-in-law is a guy named Tony West, who's the chief legal guy and, in effect, lobbyist for Uber and Lyft. They're spending $100 million to overturn on a ballot initiative to overturn a California law that gives gig workers the same rights as regular workers. So this gets pretty close to home, and you are expecting these folks, recognizing the transformative needs and the nature of the political moment, to really break with a lot of aspects of their past that were kind of in bed with the corporate guys.
Mm. So I wonder how realistic is it to expect Joe Biden, who has been in Washington for so many decades and who also does put a lot of weight on personal relationships as well, as much as he wants to talk about himself as a transitional figure for the party. It is a transition. It's not a quantum leap necessarily. So, I mean, Bob, would it be satisfactory to the progressive left if, say, some of those top positions went to, you know, some of the names we've been talking about here, those longtime trusted advisors who've been through that revolving door? Would that be satisfactory if just below them, sort of in the grooming for future leadership ranks of Washington, he put in the sort of the younger, more progressive voices?
No, because and Larry Summers' career proves this. It's the top people who make the policy, and the, you know, even if your title is undersecretary or assistant secretary, you're reporting to the top people. The top people call the shots. The top people are the ones who have the direct ear of the president. And a lot of us feel a little bit like, you know, like Charlie Brown and the football with Wall Street and the role of Lucy. It would not be acceptable. It would be deeply troubling. There's an old quote by a Marxist that goes, pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will. That sounds a little bit 1930s-ish. I prefer to translate as optimism of the heart. You have to be a pessimist based on what you know. And you have to be an optimist based on the needs of the moment and what you hope for, and fight like the devil for them.
Well,
yeah, and to that,
go ahead.
I was just going to add that to that point, I would say to all of my progressive friends, of which I consider myself a progressive as well, that what we need to do is we need to have some clear markers of milestones for the change that we want to see. It can't just be we want a Green New Deal. Okay, great. Of course we want a Green New Deal. But in order to get to the totality of that deal, there are a lot of different nuanced steps we can take that the administration from an agency perspective can start to implement and then as well be working on legislation to kind of have milestones to get us towards those goals. And that is where the rubber really meets the road. And so what remains to be seen as well is how the policy community on the progressive side is going to hold the administration accountable to the first 100 days we need ABC, D, and E, which will then prepare us to kind of move the next phase of us moving towards the ideals that we have. That is what, frankly, the LGBT community did so well around moving LGBT policy into the administration. First 100 days, we need this. Then we're going to build upon that. And if we can create a plan and a strategy to build upon, then I think we'll really win and change this entire game.
Well, with that, Bob Kuttner, I've got to let you go because we've hit a break here. But thank you so much for being with us and walking us through sort of the truth about the lobbyist and strategist connections that that Joe Biden's got surrounding him. So Bob Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and author of The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Magna. Thanks for doing this segment. It's very important stuff.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is day three of the Democratic National Convention. Yesterday, we talked about the Democrats' platform or the ideas they wish to push forward. Today, we're talking about the team that would help Joe Biden if he wins the Democratic the presidential race in November. And of course, tomorrow, we will be talking about the man himself, Joe Biden. And so we want to hear from listeners, especially I'm particularly curious about independent listeners or folks out there who haven't yet or recently made up their minds about who to vote for. What is it that you would need to hear from Joe Biden to win your vote, especially if you voted for Donald Trump in 2016? What do you need to hear from Joe Biden tomorrow to convince you to cast your ballot for him? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And tell us your story. We'll use it in tomorrow's program. Today, as I said, we are talking about the team of people that are surrounding Joe Biden now as advisors and consultants on his campaign. And if he wins in November, who might occupy very influential positions in Washington in a Biden administration? Aisha Mills joins us. She's a Democratic political strategist and commentator, was also a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. And Aisha, hang on here for just a second, because I'd like to bring into the conversation now Senator Cory Booker, United States Senator from the state of New Jersey. Senator Booker, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be on. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so the first thing I want to ask you actually has to do with something that we saw in the DNC this week already. It was a wonderful moment on Monday night when you appeared in a montage with other former 2020 presidential candidates, and you told a story to people watching about something that had happened at one of the Democratic debates, and here's what you said.
I still remember standing side by side with him on the debate stage,
and we were having a go of it. But what was remarkable to me was in the commercial break, he puts his arm around me and starts telling me how good my ideas are. And next thing you know, I feel like he's giving me a pep talk and literally telling me how important it is, how really important it is that I'm on that stage.
So that's Senator Booker in a DNC montage this week. Senator, I'm wondering now, is or has Joe Biden also whispered into your ears since then that, hey, you know, those ideas were so good that if I win, maybe you ought to come join me in the cabinet?
No, definitely not. And frankly, my focus right now is staying in the Senate. I'm up for re-election. So that's where my energy is focused on the, really what has been the greatest privilege of my life, which is to serve this great state of New Jersey. But I'll tell you this, in his very first decision that any presidential nominee has to make, you know, he showed us the kind of choices he's going to be making by choosing Kamala Harris. And so I'm excited. In a conversation I did have with him driving from Flint, Michigan to Detroit, we just talked about who he is. And he really does see himself as this bridge, bridge to the next generation of leaders. This baby boomer, the great baby boomer generation, is beginning to pass the torch. And I think he was very excited about the incredible talent that revealed itself, not just in the Democratic primary, but that he saw crisscrossing the country and engaging with people. And it's going to have a cabinet and a team that really reflects that talent and those valuable players that he wants to try to assemble. I was joking with somebody that another president, they talked about him being Camelot, but I really think that Joe Biden's going to create a roundtable of some incredible, noble public servants, and I'm excited to see it.
Well, let me ask you then, how would you put the progressive wing of the party at ease then? Because a little earlier in the program, we were talking about how all the strategists, the lobbyists, the people with corporate connections, with Wall Street connections, that Biden also has on his campaign team right now, and in advisory positions that are very close to him. How would you assure the progressive wing of the party that those voices won't drown out the big ideas that we're seeing, for example, in the platform?
Well, look, I have to say, as I think the only United States senator that lives in a black and brown community where, you know, for decades I've lived in a neighborhood, we don't mistake wealth with worth because the median income, according to the last census where I live, is about $14,000 per household. And when I hear the urgencies or talk to the issues that drive and animate people in communities like mine, when you start to say, what's a progressive wing and a moderate wing? No, there are issues that are driving people that have to be addressed because they're often life or death. And so I just tell you right now, things from raising the minimum wage so that the people in my neighborhood work longer hours than my parents, and my parents were working but still need to rely on SNAP benefits. That's something that this administration is going to be driven to do when it comes to gun violence or healthcare. I have a lot of confidence that the battles are going to be, as Bernie Sanders himself has said, thinking that this presidency could be the most forward-thinking and advancing for working people and for low-income people since FDR. So I know that it's convenient for us to think about this camp of the Democratic Party or that camp. I try to focus on the folks that are living in an America that is profoundly unjust and the urgencies to change that. And I have a lot of confidence that this administration is going to drive as hard as it can. And frankly, I was happy to hear them wanting to undermine the power, influence, and corruption of money in politics and begin to do the things that elevate people over corporations, which have to be done. And I see a commitment to do that as well. So these debates sometimes are tiresome to me because as we debate, there are still people in my neighborhood that are suffering from everything from the structural racism of our society all the way to the sheer absurdity, the obscenity of our mass system of mass incarceration. And we have a lot of work to do and debating right now when we are still in a combat with a president who every single day tells us who he is, his destructive authoritarian tendencies. we have to all get to work to get over that hurdle and then continue the work, because clearly beating Donald Trump is the floor, not the ceiling.
So, Senator Booker, point taken about empty debates, but I don't actually think this is an empty debate, because the very same people you're talking about that you represent in New Jersey or Americans across this country, they may be asking these questions because of the direct experience they had, say, following the 2008 financial crisis, where they saw the Obama administration, of who Joe Biden was the number two man, come in and put in the top members levels of the cabinet people with very close ties to Wall Street, and then what happened? Wall Street got a bailout. Individual homeowners in New Jersey did not get that bailout. So I think that people are very justified in being concerned or dubious that Democrats are making promises now about ambitious changes that they want to make to the fundamental structure of the economy. But when push comes to shove, it didn't even happen last time.
Yeah, well, again, I'm not countering your point. I guess what I'm saying is you're using... And I was a mayor of this city at that time and having to deal with unemployment rates 20, 25%. The foreclosure crisis that swept across my city like a tsunami, and watching a lot of those industries get the focus of the resources and not communities like mine. So I understand what you're saying. I guess what I'm saying is the urgency of this moment is to beat Donald Trump and to make sure that the lessons people learn from that time that we take that momentum to make sure we undo a lot of these systems of oppression in our country. And you use that one point in time. I can go back for the last 50 years that I've sort of at least been somewhat conscious and aware, maybe 40 years is more fair, that I saw these same systems manifest themselves, and unfortunately often under Democratic administrations, like we saw with mass incarceration. And so, again, my firm belief right now is that we are mounting changes because in many ways of the awfulness of this last 4 years that were not possible. I mean, Kamala and I wrote a bill that we both were talking about would not have been possible just 6 months before the vicious murders of George Floyd. That's how quickly we advanced. We're able to get almost 40 senators to sign on to a very progressive police accountability bill. And so I know there's momentum now. There's a racial reckoning going on that I hope helps sustains. But it does not take away from the fact that the House, as they say, when it's on fire, you put out the fire first and get to work later on rebuilding.
Yeah. Senator Booker, you are truly that prisoner of hope, aren't you?
You know what? Hope was defined for me best in this neighborhood from a woman who had her son murdered in the projects I used to live in at the top of my street. Hope is dashed. Hope is beaten. Hope is scarred. But hope always resurrects with this firm belief that despair will not have the last word. And that's what often people have to choose between, giving into the despair and the darkness or choosing to be agents of hope. And so whatever happens at the end of this election, and I believe Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will win, I believe we'll take back the Senate. But that's when the work really starts, because as I said to you before, beating Donald Trump might get us out of a valley, but we have a long way to go till we get to the mountaintop. And so hope works, and I'm looking forward to getting to that work after this election.
Well, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Senator, it's great to have you as always. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you as always for having me.
All right, Aisha. So just respond to what you heard Senator Booker say there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to say that, you know, America is better off for having Senator Booker's voice, period. I think we are living in such dark times, and just throughout the entirety of the presidential campaign, the primary campaign, he has been a voice of reason. Reckoning for sure, but also that optimism and that light. He is right in that we tend to get into a circular firing squad, I think, as progressives in a way that the conservatives haven't always. I mean, the Tea Party did some of this, but, you know, generally we kind of get into this space of, you know, do we want to be right or do we want to win? Or, you know, we definitely want to win, but how can we also make change in the process? Sometimes it matters that we focus on the key threat at hand. And so, you know, I appreciate that spirit of like, look, we got to get rid of Donald Trump. I also, though, you know, would invite everyone to just, and I'll keep repeating this, to just remember that when we operate out of a place of despair, out of fear, when we're just resisting, what we're doing is we're preserving something, right? We're hunkering down to try to preserve some kind of sanity. What we need to be focused on is a restoration. And not even, you know, let me take that back, not even a restoration, but an imagination of what our country could be. And so I do appreciate when the senator, you know, reminds us that, like, yes, we got to fight, we got to get, you know, rid of this guy, this is bad. But now where do we go from here is the bigger spirit of the question. And in my humble opinion, what I have heard from people that I talk to, and I've been spending, as so many of us have, a lot of time with my family, just kind of hunkered down during COVID, and just hearing from average workers, regular folks like my family, that people really do want to imagine the future in a bigger, bolder way, and that that is what kind of will get us excited and animated. Yes, we need to fight. Donald Trump is horrible, but beat over the head with so much that's going on. And who can we talk to about, like, the excitement of what we could be? I mean, this is like a crazy time. Let's just start over and make up, you know, a brand new system that works for everybody. That is the part that we do need to lean into more. And I'm hoping that in the next, you know, two nights, tonight and tomorrow, this is it, we're halfway through with the convention, that we start to feel some of that spirit, because we've got to have an imagination and somewhere that we're going forward to. We can't just be, you know, hunkered down with our arms over our head because we're getting beat up. We've now got to stand up and, like, figure out what we're going to do next.
Well, we just got a couple of minutes left, Ayesha, and I just want to switch gears a tiny bit and ask you what you think about how this convention's been going so far. I mean, and especially about the role that women have been playing, because of course we had the former First Lady on Monday night with a powerhouse speech. We had Dr. Jill Biden last night. Senator Harris is going to speak tonight. So is Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi. Just your thoughts on what we've been seeing so far.
I am a Democrat because I believe that despite it all, Democrats really, really try to reflect and represent the totality of America. Women are the majority of America. We are powerful. Black women are going to save our souls. You know, Speaker Pelosi has been one of, in my opinion, the most influential and effective legislators of, you know, of a generation or two. So, you know, we've got women, but not just in a way that is simply tokenized, like, oh, put the women in front because that, like, makes people feel good. I mean, these are powerful people who have done really amazing work. And it reminds us to see ourselves reflected back through them, that we together can make this abundant change. In addition to the women, just the diversity on display generally. Last night, there were there were at least three LGBTQ elected officials who were speaking. There were so many people of color from all walks of life that were speaking. I loved my favorite part so far, other than Michelle Obama's speech, which, you know, when she just opens her mouth, I mean, I think we all kind of get excited. But my favorite part was the roll call.
I don't want to go back to the old roll call ever again, to be honest.
Ever again. I mean, to see, like, you know, American Samoa, like, stand up and the Virgin Islands.
Calamari on a Rhode Island beach. Like, come on.
And to see the black man in Maine, for example, that has a bed and breakfast there or an inn, whatever it was. Also, what I think that did is it united us. It showed us that 50 states plus the territories in the District of Columbia, surely we are distinct and we are different. We have our own cultures. There's something interesting everywhere in this country. But taken together, we are the United States of America. And it is that diversity that makes us so powerful. And that was that entire attempt. I think that they have done probably the best job at really bringing in voices that are diverse, whether they be women, whether they be people of color, but more importantly, just average workers, just regular folks. That is the promise of America and the party.
Well, Ayesha Mills, Democratic political strategist, political commentator. She was also a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics and former president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund, and was also former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Ayesha, it's always great to have you. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.